just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair, then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today I'm happy to have with me Elizabeth Benedict. Elizabeth's five critically acclaimed novels have established her reputation as a writer who specializes in the subterranean currents of modern relationships, the secret motivations and betrayals that underlie everyday interactions. Her first novel, Slow Dancing, published in 1985, was shortlisted for the National Book Award. Almost was a bestseller and a New York Times notable book. She is also the author of several other novels, the most current of which is The Practice of Deceit. And she has also written The Joy of Writing Sex, which is used widely in writing programs. Actually, I've used it with my students as well. And she's taught fiction and nonfiction writing at Princeton, the Iowa Writers Workshop, Swarthmore College, and Harvard Extension, and has written for many publications, including The New York Times, Selma Gundy, Esquire, Tin House, Harper's Bazaar, and The American Prospect. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
We have so much to talk about. I'm glad you're going to be with us for an hour today. Where shall we start? Novel writing came first, yes?
I'm sorry, what did?
Novel writing?
Novel writing, yes, it did. Yes. I was at Barnard in the mid-1970s, and it was very exotic then to want to be a writer. Now it's not nearly so exotic. But I had the great privilege of having a writing tutorial when I was a senior with Elizabeth Hardwick. And writing novels was a very noble, as I say, exotic thing to think about doing for your life back then. I didn't know a lot of other people who aspired to that. But I was very, very, very committed to it. And the The journalism that I've come to do over the last 10 or 15 years has come out of my work as a novelist, or I guess my reputation, or I did a lot of book reviews. I did book reviewing exclusively, but I branched out into all different kinds of journalism and personal essay writing. But it did all come from the kind of discipline of writing novels.
Now, when you were at Barnard, did you start with short stories?
Yes.
Talk about that, because I think a lot of new writers, especially if they're surrounded by novelists or if their instructor is a novelist, feel that they should jump right into that form of fiction as well, whereas short stories...
Into novel writing.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of writing short fiction, how that sort of prepares you.
Well, I think it's just naturally you start small. I mean, you start with short poems rather than long poems. You start with a short bike ride rather than a long bike ride. And, you know, William Faulkner said that novelists are failed short story writers. in a real way, I like writing novels more than I like writing short stories. I like the room that novels give you, and I like the room in which to explore things that you're not sure of the outcomes of. But I think it's very natural. I think there are fashions, and I think it's natural to start out writing short stories. Just because writing a novel is much too intimidating. A short story can be 8 or 10 or 12 pages. A novel could be 300 pages. So I think it's where you naturally, it's what you naturally gravitate to when you begin. But now, because writing fiction has become such an industry and has become so commodified, and there are so many writing programs and so many novels published, I think people sort of think of it more in a business way, and I think most people do write short stories in workshops, but, you know, you hear about these 12-year-old kids writing novels. and I think there are all kinds of reasons for it. I think one of them is because people have computers, and it's much easier to physically write long than it was when you had to write on a manual typewriter or you had to write by hand.
Yeah.
I mean, people's dissertations are three times as long now because they can go to the library and scan hundreds of pages of documents. And so I think physically it's easier to write a novel. And I think it tricks people into thinking that maybe aesthetically it's also easier. But when I started writing, I wrote on an electric typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And I used whiteout, and every time I wanted to revise, I had to
start over
at the top of the page. And there was a lot of scissors and pieces of scotch tape and whiteout and those little white crinkly things that got powder everywhere. It was physically much harder.
Yeah.
So I do think it's a bit of a style that young people think that they should write a novel right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are so many novels, and there are so many different kinds of novels, you know, that it's not as intimidating to young people as writing a novel was to me when I was young.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because I was looking at, you know, Kafka and Faulkner and, you know, and a few dozen contemporary writers, but not tens of thousands of contemporary
mm-hmm.
writers. You know, it's really the numbers are just so much different than they were when I was in college.
Right.
The numbers of women writers, the numbers of young people writers. I mean, there's probably, you know, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of late teenagers who are writing YA novels or novels very geared toward young people, and it's a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should have started reading your stuff weeks ago before the show rather than just a week or two, because I read your last two novels, which are Almost and The Practice of Deceit, and of course The Joy of Writing Sex. And first I wanted to talk about your novels, and we probably will even dip into your guide, because it also has to do with these novels. But why I wish I had started earlier, because I saw such connections between these two novels that now I'm so curious to see where you started out, what slow dancing was, and then how it went into The Beginner's Book of Dreams and Safe Conduct, and if there's a thread. Do you see a thread through all of your books? Because with Almost and The Practice of Deceit, there were very definite threads that I found that I'll talk about.
Well, would you want to give me a hint?
Well, well, just that these two...
I've never thought about this. No, I'm kidding.
Well, these two, the style was similar in that they were both basically a retelling of something that had happened. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. both first person, past tense, and here I'm going to tell you a story about...
Looking back over the shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. What happened when? And that was really kind of an interesting form. And especially interesting that you did it in both of them, and I found it really compelling and really liked the form very much. Both deal with issues of fertility and parenthood, and both, of course, have sex in them in the most literary way, but that's not really the thing I'm talking about. It's really more the style of the books and sort of the themes you're dealing with, deception, you know, kids.
Well, I think I've always been interested in moments between people, and in exploring the richness of significant moments between people, and of course the moments, you know, when dramatic things happen between people, echo way back in their lives and in stories, and so you know the power of those moments. Is there because of everything that's led up to them. And so that's always been very interesting to me, sort of how people connect and how they try to connect and how they end up disconnecting and how they aspire to be together and how they keep sort of failing to be together, how they aspire to be someone and they keep failing to be someone, or they get to be the person they want to be and then they find out it's really not the person they wanted to be after all. And so I'm very interested in kind of people's disappointments and people's ambitions and a lot in the way people try to connect and connect. And sometimes their connections are very passionate and intense, but whenever there's a sort of passionate, intense connection, as any good storyteller knows, the connection can be broken. And that's kind of what drama is about. It's about these reversals, reversals of fortune, reversals of love, of connection, of security. And so all of this sort of muck of life, I guess I've always been very interested in. But I'm also interested in, I mean, that makes the stories and the characters and the book sound very dreary. But what I'm really as interested in is the kind of the dark things and the difficult things that people have to deal with, but the surfaces of my books, I think, they have a kind of light surface. They tend to be kind of funny, and they read fast, and the style of them is sometimes antithetical to the sort of sadness of the subject. And I do this on purpose. I'm aware of what I'm doing. And, you know, it really has to do with how we survive. I mean, I think that people survive life day to day by making jokes. And we survive all kinds of horrors, whether they're political or personal or health, by making jokes. And by making light, by trying to dismiss the gravity of things. And that, I think I try to do something similar to that in the style of my books. I try to entice the reader into thinking this is going to be sort of fun, And even in the novel Almost, which is about a sudden death and a very, very traumatic situation that's very dark, part of the challenge of writing the book for me was to keep the surface of the book crackling and not exactly funny, but so that it was fun to read, even though you were reading about really grim, difficult things. And that's important to me, and I think it's just a survival technique in terms of how people get through life. And as a literary technique, I think it I'm not supposed to talk about entertainment, but I think part of the pleasure of reading and of getting involved in a story is just the pleasure of the story, the pleasure of the language, the fact that it's something other than a transcript of life or a tragic sort of commentary about tragic events. You know, I think we read for something else. We read to get all kinds of different pleasures, but I think one of the pleasures is the pleasures of the page and the pleasures of language, the pleasures, the aesthetic pleasures, and also the pleasures of seeing somebody sort of writing against the darkness of the material without dishonoring it, without being flip. You know, it's not David Sedaris kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's darkly funny. It's more literary than that, in the sense that I'm much more aware of creating a certain kind of surface, even though there's a dark story underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the threads are some of those dark subjects contrasted with a surface that I think is kind of shiny and I hope pleasurable to read, and that kind of tricks you into thinking that the story might be a little more fun than it actually is. And that the issues, you know, and that the issues are more serious than they might seem at first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a copy editor read The Practice of Deceit, and she said, you know, for a book that's about divorce and personality disorders and sociopaths and real dark stuff, this was so much fun to read. That was a great reaction, but I think the darkness of the touch doesn't diminish the seriousness of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So those are some of the things that I think run through all of the books.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, and I'm here today with Elizabeth Benedict, who has written 5 novels and a guide called The Joy of Writing Sex, a guide for fiction writers. And the novels that we're talking about are Almost and The Practice of Deceit. Curious about The Practice of Deceit, speaking of, the various things you just said about sociopaths and personality disorders and such. You've also written it from a male point of view, which is extremely effective, and wanted to talk to you about why, of course, but also just your experience of writing in the male point of view.
It was very strange, and it took a long time to figure out how to do. I didn't set out to write this book. I was actually minding my own business one night in my apartment, reading a letter from Birmingham Jail by Martin Luther King in a collection of essays. And I was also reading a book. I was helping a friend with a very difficult personal situation, and I was reading a book called In Sheep's Clothing, and it was the subtitle, I think, was something like How to Deal with Manipulative People.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read the Martin Luther King essay as I was reading this other book, and then I took out a piece of paper and I started very innocently writing a story. I think it was a legal pad or a 3x5 card. Started writing a story about a man in jail, and this really had never happened to me before, and I just was sort of writing and writing and writing, and this whole story came to me of this man in jail, and obviously I was thinking about Martin Luther King, and also this book about dealing with manipulative people, and this whole kind of novel just sort of sprung onto the page, and I said to myself, Martin Luther King wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail. So this is Letter from the what jail? And I did this sort of Dr. Seuss game of what rhymes with jail. And the first thing I thought was Scarsdale, where the book is set. And I said, oh, Scarsdale. Of course I can do Scarsdale. I'm a New Yorker. I grew up near Scarsdale. If I had thought Scottsdale, I wouldn't have said it in Scottsdale because I'm not that interested in Scottsdale, but Scarsdale really seemed like the appropriate setting for this story. So the book really came out of a bizarre kind of reading list, you know. and suddenly I was writing about this man in jail, and I realized that the only way I could sustain a male narrator for the length of a book was if he was something like a psychologist or a psychiatrist, because he would be so specifically interested in people's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that there was enough overlap, you know, between the sexes, even in this area. I realized very suddenly that it would be great if his wife were kind of the opposite of him. And so he's a sensitive guy, shrink, and his wife is a ruthless lawyer. And so I think right away I had this role reversal where he's the sensitive guy and she's the manipulative one and not so sensitive. And so those parts of the book kind of came to me early on. But it took me a long time to find the man's voice. And at first, his voice was very placid. And I wrote a number of chapters in this very placid voice. And I had them married for 15 years. And then he finds out his wife isn't quite the person he thought he was. And I thought it was wonderful, of course. And I sent it to an editor who's published some of my work. And he wrote back and said, thanks for letting me see this. And, you know, that was about it. And I realized the guy's voice wasn't quite as interesting as I thought it was. And I did something I do often, and I think a lot of writers do. I went to a bookstore, and I started just picking up books to be inspired or to sort of try to set off a spark. And I was very, very lucky. I picked up Nick Hornby's book, A High Fidelity, mm-hmm. which I had picked up a number of times before, but it just wasn't in the right mood. And that day, the book just kind of, you know, it was like a cat that leaped at my face. And suddenly that funny, smart voice of the narrator in Nick Hornby's book just spoke. And that was the beginning of writing about, from Eric's point of view, in the voice that finally came to be his. And it allowed him to be funny and angry, and he was in the midst of chaos. And I find that fiction is about chaos. It's about kind of working one's way out of chaos. I mean, that's often, stories begin in chaos or they end in chaos. Read Moby Dick. But somehow that the Nick Hornby voice of that book really helped me to find Eric's voice. That was the beginning. So there were certain places where Eric would describe something, and he would go on and on and on, and I'd say, a man would never do this, and I'd cut the description, you know, just because it seemed like a woman going on too much. But the trick with Eric was that he was our narrator, and I had to have him show us the world of the book. So he couldn't be too much of a guy. He couldn't, you know, be too withholding. So I had him say things like, well, I never noticed women's makeup, but this woman really had a lot of makeup on. And when he sees the baby that will become his stepdaughter, he looks at her and he says, well, what do I know? I'm a bachelor. You know, mm-hmm. she was a baby. Mm-hmm. And whereas a woman, even a woman who didn't have children, wouldn't have said that about a baby.
Mm-hmm.
But so there were these certain moments certain kinds of descriptions when I was very aware that he was a man, and but he was also the narrator, so he had to tell us what we needed to know, but he also had to say, I'm a guy, and this isn't, you know, I don't usually notice women's pantyhose, you know, or what shoes they're wearing. So there was sometimes a delicate balance, and it was sometimes a struggle, but it was very interesting. And I must say, I gave the manuscript to a number of men, and to make sure that the scenes, that the voice and the scenes and the observations and the emotions made sense. And there were many cases where they said, you know, no, I think he would be angry here. No, this doesn't quite make sense. I'm not sure why he's doing this. So, I work, of course, we write alone, but writing is ultimately a collaborative act. And, you know, there are lots of people who read things along the way to make sure that they make sense.
Yeah.
And so I did get a lot of comments and criticism.
Mm. Well, when we come back, I hope you will read to us from The Practice of Deceit.
Thanks.
We're going to take a real short break, so all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Elizabeth Benedict.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of Irvine campus, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, University of California, Irvine campus. Sorry about that. And want to say that my website, penonfire.com, has a link to the radio page. That is where you can go to listen to, 100-some podcasts of previous shows. This show will be up in another week or two, so that you can listen to it again and tell everybody about it. And I also want to say Elizabeth Benedict, who is today's guest, will be at the ASJA conference in April. Last week we had on Jeanette Walls, who's the keynote speaker for the conference, and Elizabeth is going to be on a panel about writing about sex, actually. And that's on Saturday, I believe it's the 21st of April. It's that weekend anyway, the third weekend. And if you want to know more about the conference, go to asja.org. I'm going to bring Elizabeth back on. Hi there.
Hi.
So will you read to us from The Practice of Deceit?
Okay. This is from a chapter called Sandy Lefkowitz is Having a Bad Day. And Eric and his wife live in Scarsdale. Eric is the husband. He's the therapist, the nice guy set therapist. And his wife's name is Colleen, and she's a lawyer and a divorce lawyer. And Eric has just seen a client of his, Sandy Lefkowitz, who's a sort of a guy who's kind of a mess, who's just gotten served divorce papers. And when Eric says, "Who's your wife's lawyer?" Sandy shuffles all these legal papers, and he says, let's see, her name is Colleen O'Brien, and Eric is surprised to find that that's his own wife. Eric and his wife have different last names. And so he's very shocked that his wife has been responsible for his clients being kicked out of his house. And Eric is recounting what he does after he sees his client. "I rarely had occasion to go to her office in the village, a 7-minute walk from our house. The building is an Art Deco complex from the 1930s, austere in a pleasing way. You are paying for location when you hire a lawyer or accountant in this building, not for frills, not for Mark Rothko in the lobby or state-of-the-art elevators. The doors to each office are the quaint wooden glass design you recognize from old black-and-white movies, the name of the firm or the individual painted painstakingly on the milky glass in letters that will be razored off and replaced with a new name by the end of the movie. Eric, hi, how are you? Ruth, Colleen's secretary, was hovering over a computer keyboard and monitor. Is she in, I said? Ruth nodded. Colleen, who could see me through the open door, waved me in and motioned to the chair on the other side of her desk. Her office was small, simple, and elegant, with a large window behind her desk overlooking the train station. She was writing something on a Post-it note and speaking into the phone. I'm not available for the next, 3 weeks. No, 4. Oh, sorry, make that 6. I have back-to-back trials, then a 2-week break where I have depositions almost every day. It's a hell of a schedule. Of course I understand what the issue is. What, $30,000? I'm not sure my accountant would come up with the same number, but it's irrelevant because I don't have time to meet with you to discuss it until November. Can't get blood from a stone, Mr. Goodman. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm already late for a meeting. Sorry about the schedule." She replaced the phone in its cradle and looked up at me. "Hi, hon, what can I do for you? You have trials every day for the next 6 weeks? Did you forget to tell me?" "Oh, no, sweetie, not at all. That's just lawyer talk. My only upcoming trial is the week after next for 2 days. "Lawyer talk for what?" "I'm not ready to negotiate yet. That's all it means. Goodman's a lawyer. He knows. What's up? Is everything all right?" I got up and closed the door. When I turned, I could see Colleen thought something had happened to the children. Her cheeks reddened, her eyes grew. I let her fear that possibility for a few more seconds than necessary. "Can you explain to me what's going on with Sandy Lefkowitz?" "What? I don't understand what you're doing to him. How do you know him?" "None of your business." Did you get off on the right floor, Eric? What do you think? Who do you think you are talking to me that way? I want to know what you're doing to him. I want to know what you're doing to me, barging in here like this. Are you going to tell me what this is about, or should I guess? Take a guess. For Christ's sake, Eric, I don't have time for this. I'm on my way to a meeting, so make it quick. I had heard this nasty tone before, and those nasty flourishes, and they always sent a shiver through me. He's my patient, I said. Why didn't you say so? You served him papers last night when he got home from work. You kicked him out of his house without consulting him, without letting him say goodbye to his son. I was acting on behalf of his wife. Sweetheart, let me give you some free legal advice, and we can talk about this later. You have a conflict of interest in your relationship with him. He'll have to get a new therapist. Or she'll need a new lawyer, I said. He came to me before she came to you. Really? She looked down at her date book open on her desk. Consultation, Ursula Higginbotham, June 12th, 10 a.m. Let me see. You don't trust me? I'd like to see it. You think I would invent an appointment? Then it shouldn't be a problem to see it. The problem is trust. And if you're saying, I reached for the date book, and before I could fully extend my hand, she grabbed the book and slammed it shut. There, she said, and dropped it on the other side of her desk. I gaped at her for a long moment, and she gaped back, which was more frightening to me than if she had looked away. She was not going to back down, and now I wasn't going to either.
Thank you so much.
You're
welcome.
That
was Elizabeth Benedict reading from The Practice of Deceit. There's so many plot turns in this book. I know you said that it sort of just came to you, the idea for it, when you were reading the Martin Luther King letter, but how intricately plotted was this? I mean, did you sit down and spend weeks or months really fleshing out the story before you started writing?
It was more plotted than my other books, and the material really lent itself to that. The plot went through a lot of revisions, and because the character Eric starts out in jail, I was always aware of having to have him. He had to have done something that was grave enough to land him in jail, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. So I was working on the plot during the time I was writing the book. I didn't plot it all out beforehand, and there, I did a lot of research along the way, and I consulted a lot of lawyers. I consulted all kinds of people. So the plot evolved as the book evolved. And there were certain scenes, like when he goes to get arraigned, I didn't know what happened at an arraignment. And I wasn't even sure what I wanted to have happen, but I consulted this criminal lawyer, and I said, well, I want him to be freed after the arraignment. And so what would have to happen at the arraignment for him to be freed? And so this lawyer kind of gave me ideas for what would have to happen, and he gave me some language that he as a lawyer would say in that situation. So it really, the plot, it's very hard to break it down to say, well, this I thought of before and this I thought of after. But because the book starts with Eric in jail, there was a certain level of intensity and gravity that everything had to rise to in order for it to make sense that he ends up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
The stakes had to be very high because I start him off in jail. So it was always a matter of making sure that Colleen was sort of wicked enough, but without being. She was wicked enough, but she was believable because she's sort of a con artist. So she's conned him into thinking that she's a certain way. So, you know, it was very hard to work out the details, and there was a lot of revision. Even once I sold the book, you know, working out people's motivations. And the plotting, I wish I could give you an easy answer, like I just wrote the whole plot out and it was fine. But it wasn't like that. It was much more intricate and much more, it kept getting changed as along.
Well, that's good, though, because you were writing it and it was getting changed. It wasn't,
yeah.
You know, you hear about some people that sit down and get the plot so solid before they start writing, and you go, what am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, I suppose it makes the writing faster. they can produce books more easily or more quickly. But I think there's something about living with the material and with the characters that makes things. I think you can feel it when it's come in a difficult way to the author.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes too easily, you can feel that too, and it seems kind of slick.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just I'm being defensive for not being able to crank out books.
That's so funny, because I was just going to say, you write all these books. Do you consider yourself prolific? It seems like you get them out pretty quickly.
Well, I'll let that illusion stand, but it doesn't quite. They take many years to write.
Hmm.
They take many years to write. I can attest to that. I guess cumulatively, it looks like there are a lot of them, but they did take a long time.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I would really love to talk about The Joy of Writing Sex, because this is such a useful text for so many reasons. And first, I'd just like to ask you, what brought it about?
What brought it about was very banal. A publisher asked me to write this book, and I would have to say I would never have written it had the publisher not asked me to. This was a woman who owned Story magazine, and she was interested in putting out a line of sort of Tony how to write books, and she thought I would be a good person to write this book. And she had the title, The Joy of Writing Sex, but she didn't have anything else. And she asked me because she had read some of the sex scenes I'd written, and she knew that I taught for many years, and she asked me if I was interested, and it seemed like a very inviting proposition, if you will. But in order to get the contract, I then had to basically write a proposal. I had to conceptualize the whole book. Long before I started writing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually where I had to come up with the plot before I started writing it. And I sort of spent a month or two trying to figure out how to organize the book and what the table of contents would be and what the theories of sort of how to teach people how to write about sex. And so that's one case where I did a lot of work before I started writing it. So I have to say, the publisher asked me to write it, and it seemed like a really interesting idea from the beginning. And much to my surprise, the book has been in print for 10 years. I did a revision of it a few years ago because sex had actually changed. Hard to believe, but the internet had changed things. I had written about sex in the age of AIDS, and AIDS treatment had changed, and therefore the way people wrote about sex in fiction had changed. Sex in the age of AIDS had changed in a period of 5 years. And so I did a revision, and the book, it's been around for 10 years, and its longevity has surprised me.
Yeah, well, there's nothing out like it, for one thing, and I think for, especially for literary fiction writers, it's really useful because, when you write about, when you do sex scenes and you consider yourself a literary writer, or at least that's what you're trying to do, you don't want to write a scene that would be interpreted as being something, that would be in a romance novel.
Mm-hmm.
It seems easy to fall into stereotyped scenes or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that, about, if you are, are there any things that as a literary writer you would want to think about when you're writing a romantic scene or a sex scene as opposed to if you're a romance writer? I mean, what would be some of the differences?
Let me answer you somewhat circuitously. When I had to figure out how to structure this book, I really had no idea how to organize it at the most basic level. Do I organize it by gays and straights or by types of sex, or, you know, what's the most basic organizing principle? And I had the table of contents. And I sat down and reread a bunch of sex scenes in sort of famous books that like Fear of Flying and some Philip Roth books, and as I read, I said to myself, what is it that drives these sex scenes? What is it that makes them go, if it gives them their energy? And that what made them go, what made them work, was the relation. The most important thing in each of the scenes was the relationship the characters had to each other. So whether they were strangers on a train, or they were married people, or they were like a Nazi and a Jew in Germany in 1943, or they were adulterers, that relationship was the most important thing in the scene, and everything else sort of followed from that. And so I would have to, and that's a lot the way the book is structured, examining the different kinds of sexual relationships that people have, and what are some of the given circumstances that goes with each of those relationships that have to be included in a scene. I would have to guess, because I don't read a lot of romances, you'll be surprised to hear, but I would have to guess that in a romance or in other kinds of genre fiction, what's more, the relationship people have with each other is not so important. It's the sex act or the frothiness of the sex act or the over-the-topness of the sex act that is what it's all about. And I would think that in romances and genres and in more pornography, and certainly in pornography, the sex has to be great. It has to be, even in things like Judith Krantz books or whoever, you know, Joan Collins or books like that. I don't know whether those are romances, but the sex is always great, or else it's a horrible failure and then it's sort of a joke, you know. But there are very few subtleties in between, but it's usually about great sex because the point of it is sort of escapist, you know, fantasy. And so I guess that's the main difference. And, you know, one of my basic principles in the book is that a good sex scene does not have to be about good sex. And, in fact, it's much more interesting if it's not about good sex or if it's about sex that's somewhat disappointing in some way. And of course, pornography, if it's about bad sex, you know, you lose your customer. So there are really serious differences. And I'm much more interested in the complexities of the relationship, and what each of those relationships requires of a sex scene. You know, for example, if, one of the more fun kinds of sex scenes is writing about married sex or reading about married sex, and nobody does this better than John Updike. But, you know, married sex partners tend to be, you know, I hate to say it, sort of bored with each other. And so writing a sex scene about people who are bored can be really amazing and quite a challenge. And so, you know, those are the things that I'm interested in as a writer and a reader more than in a turn-on scene.
Yeah. Well, I love one of the quotes that's on the cover of the book by Peter Carey, who wrote Oscar and Lucinda. And he said, "Read it because it will teach you everything you need to know about writing good fiction, whether your characters are having sex or having breakfast." And this is so true about this book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really just wonderful. I love the examples that you include, too. You include a ton of stuff from novels and in different aspects and what a good book.
Thank you very much.
We are getting to the end of our time here, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
My advice,
your advice,
is that good writing takes a long time, and good writing is all about rewriting. And you need to have patience. If you don't have patience, you can't do it. And I don't mean just sort of, you know, the patience of a saint, but the patience of someone who just does the work and just believes that it in order to do the work, you have to keep redoing it and redoing it, and that eventually it will get better. And it's a little bit like playing a musical instrument or doing sports. And in order to get good at it, you really have to put in your time. You don't just wake up one day playing violin.
Yeah.
And I think we think, because it's the same language that we speak all the time or the same language that's in the newspaper, that it can come easily to us. And I think that we need to get disabused of that idea.
Mm.
And it just takes a long time. And you have to be patient with it, and you have to be patient with yourself, and you have to be patient with what you read, and read a lot. I meet a lot of young writers who want to be writers, but they don't like to read. You're not going to probably be a great writer if you don't like to read. Maybe I'm going out on a limb there. But reading is how you learn how to write. Is that enough advice?
Yeah, that's great advice, especially.
I'm sure it's advice nobody wants to hear.
Well, but it's the real stuff, and that's what everybody needs to hear. So.
Yeah, and how to get an agent. Well, that's for next week. No.
Right. Well, you'll have to come on again because there's just more to talk about here. So thanks so much for spending the time.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay.
That was Elizabeth Benedict. She's author of The Joy of Writing Sex, Practice of Deceit, Almost, and four other novels. And she has a website, which is elizabethbenedict.com. I think that's it for today. If you want to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com and click on the radio tower. You'll go to the radio page. You'll see the schedule, which is updated now and then. And if you want to be on the email list, which means you'll get an email every Thursday morning that's current, as opposed to the schedule on the website, you'll know who's going to be on. What else? I think that's it for now. But I'm going to leave you with another quote by Ernest Hemingway, who said to Maxwell Perkins in Selected Letters, he said, "We'll work again on the novel today. Writing is a hard business, Max, but nothing makes you feel better." That's it. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we'll see you next time. Be well.